If you'd like to listen to our podcasts without ads, please consider becoming a member. In addition to no ads, members receive bonus content for virtually all of our shows, an invitation to join the DSR Slack community, access to our Discord community, enhanced show notes for select shows, and more. For this week only, get 50% off the first year or the first month of membership. Visit thedsrnetwork.com/buy and use code ECLIPSE to receive the discount. That's thedsrnetwork.com/buy and code ECLIPSE. Thank you very much for your support.
Hello and welcome to the DSR Daily. Sometimes we're known as the DSR Daily Doom Scroll because this is when we look through social media, try and find the stories that we think are important to you and talk about them a little bit. I'm David Rothkopf. I'm joined by Chris Cotnor and Riley Fessler. How are you today, Chris?
I'm well, thanks.
Excellent. And Riley?
Pretty good.
So, Riley, what's your top story?
During a visit to Jerusalem, UK Foreign Secretary David Cameron advocated for minimal escalation in Middle East tensions, particularly urging leaders to strategically manage their response to Iran's significant missile and drone attack. However, in the same trip, Cameron also said that it was clear Israel had already decided to retaliate. Amidst discussions with Israeli officials and plans to meet with Palestinian Authority Prime Minister, Cameron also said that his aim is to bolster G7 efforts for coordinated sanctions against Iran to curb its regional influence. Lord Cameron is one of several Western foreign ministers who are expected to visit Israel in the coming days to convey that message in person, including the German foreign minister and others.
Yeah, well, I yesterday tweeted something out to the effect of, couldn't they use the attack they did on the Damascus consular annex as pre-payback? In other words, you know, we can look at this a variety of ways, and both sides are going to look at it in the way that suits them, to suggest that the other side was responsible for this thing, and that's how you get into an escalatory spiral, which we're necessarily, everybody's trying to avoid here, not just because escalation is bad, but because every time there's an attack, something could go wrong that could trigger something much worse. And it's the kind of law of unintended consequences people are trying to avoid. I think there's a lot of advice going to the Israelis like, okay, look, if you feel like you've got to respond, how about cyber? You know, turn the lights out in Tehran, turn the lights out in a nuclear facility, try to do something that doesn't have these kind of secondary effects associated with it. That we know that there are some not so cool heads in the Israeli cabinet, and so the possibility of something that triggers yet another wave of escalation is a very real one right now. Chris?
The BBC, in collaboration with Media Zona and independent volunteers, documented that over 50,000 Russian soldiers have died in the Ukraine conflict, revealing a stark increase in fatalities as Russia employed increasingly aggressive tactics. The second year of fighting alone accounted for more than 27,300 deaths, marking a significant rise due to what has been described as a meat grinder strategy involving relentless frontal assaults to deplete Ukrainian forces and gain territorial advantages. Meanwhile, three Russian missiles struck an eight-floor apartment building in the downtown area of Chernihiv, a northern Ukrainian city approximately 150 kilometers north of Kyiv, resulting in at least eight deaths and 18 injuries. The attack occurs as the conflict enters its third year, with the war reaching a possible critical point due to Ukraine facing diminishing military support from Western allies, including the United States of America.
Yeah, look, the U.S. Congress has blood on its hands. Those people died because Ukraine does not have the air defense wherewithal to protect their citizens anymore. You can only imagine what would happen if in some other kind of a war, as for example, the one in Israel, you had these kind of civilian casualties. The reality is that 6 months of delay have led to the loss of hundreds or thousands of lives in Ukraine. Now that's about to potentially change. I, you know, talk to Democrats and there is some optimism that Mike Johnson is going to move forward with an approach where there's four aid bills, one for Ukraine, one for Israel, one for Taiwan, one for other, that will be voted on independently. There is, you know, some haggling over it because Republicans did not want there to be any aid for Gaza in the bill. Democrats have said that's a red line issue. But the other thing Democrats have said is that if that's what happens and then some extremist Republicans come after Johnson, then the Democrats may vote on Johnson's behalf to keep him in office. Would be an interesting twist. Jared Moskowitz was one of the Democrats who said that yesterday specifically that he would vote for him. And it could make this week extremely eventful. But of course, you know, discussing it in political terms is one thing. Discussing it in terms of the lives in Ukraine that are affected by this is quite another. And that's the thing that needs to be kept front and center in our minds as we look at it. Riley?
Russia's foreign ministry has been developing strategies to diminish Western influence, particularly targeting the United States, and to assert a new global order less dominated by American hegemony, as revealed in a secret addendum to Russia's foreign policy concept. Now, I'll preface this by saying this is all stuff that we already basically knew that Russia was doing, but this is really the first time we've seen it kind of codified and written down in official Russian documents, so I think it is still interesting. The classified document outlines an aggressive stance with initiatives across military, economic, and international fronts aimed at exploiting vulnerabilities in Western policies, and includes the approach of forming closer alliances with China, Iran, and North Korea to alter the global power balance. And again, I mean, this is stuff that is pretty patently obvious, but I think it's interesting how we now kind of have a greater insight into how it is actually couched in the internal Russian system.
Well, it's patently obvious to you because you can read. I mean, you know, it's not patently obvious to Marjorie Taylor Greene or to a bunch of these far right folks who are actively supporting Russia. It was summed up for me, I thought, extremely well in a tweet I saw earlier today from Ann Applebaum, who is a contributor to The Atlantic and to other publications, is a really one of the best writers and experts out there on things pertaining to Russia, Eastern and Central Europe. And she said, you know, Russia treats us as though we're an enemy. We don't many of us do not. Russia views themselves as being at war with us and is approaching things in that way. And it's really important. And documents like the one you referred to, Riley, demonstrate this. People sometimes talk about a new Cold War, with China or with Russia. And I, you know, would argue that we're in a Cold War with neither of them, because we're so interdependent on China. And with Russia, it's a hot war. But we will continue to see some of that hot war played out in American politics because one entire political party is now on the side of this country that thinks it's at war with us. How about that? That's a real strange twist of events. Chris?
Well, speaking of China, the United States Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin and his Chinese counterpart Dong Zhan engage in their first significant discussion in nearly 18 months via video conference, focusing on restoring military ties between the two nations. During the meeting, Austin highlighted the importance of respecting international laws concerning freedom of navigation, especially in the South China Sea, a region of escalating tensions due to conflicting territorial claims and recent incidents involving China in the Philippines, a U.S. treaty ally. Dong emphasized China's position on Taiwan, which he declared as the core of China's core interests. called for the United States to respect China's territorial sovereignty.
Yeah, well, you know, one of the things that I admire most in an administration with regard to foreign policy, having covered it now for much longer than Riley has been alive, is that some administrations, you know, show aptitude for foreign policy, some don't. But the rarest of all things to see in an administration is learning from your mistakes, saying we were wrong and embracing another policy. And I think what has happened in this administration is that it started out, and perhaps with the prodding of the Chinese and the very first meetings that took place between Secretary Blinken and Jake Sullivan and the Chinese in Anchorage, Alaska, and so forth, that this we got into a very contentious footing, kind of peaked with the balloon incident. And everybody said, hey, whoa, wait a minute. That is not in anybody's interest here to be in a directly confrontational exchange. Things like the balloon incident underscore that we need to have open dialogue between our military so they understand what they're doing and we don't have any accidents. We have plenty of economic reasons, which is why, for example, you've seen Secretary Yellen go over there again for a second time. Just now, you'll see Secretary Raimondo do the same thing. And so there has been this adjustment. It's not to say that the administration does not view China as a rival. And in fact, the president is talking about setting a new set of tariffs on Chinese steel and aluminum because they're dumping it in the U.S. market at lower than market rates, and that's causing disruption. So there, you know, it's a two-way street, but it's not a one-way street. And that's the important thing. When you've got 70,000 U.S. companies operating in China, China is one of our leading economic partners. China is a crucial partner on sort of the whole host of transnational issues. This kind of balance is what's called for. And it's smart. Riley?
Sweden is on the brink of passing a transformative law that would simplify the process of legally changing one's gender, lowering the age at which individuals can make this change to 16, with parental medical consent required for those under 18. Proposals are aimed at streamlining both the surgical and administrative aspects of gender transition and have sparked, as you can imagine, significant political and social debate. Sweden was actually the first country to introduce legal gender reassignment in 1972, but clearly the debate has continued to rage. Critics are concerned about the implications for gender-specific spaces and potential for precipitating medical transitions among young people, which is certainly something echoed in the U.S., while supporters argue the changes are crucial for the rights and well-being of transgender individuals. And I just chose this story to highlight really the differences between Sweden on this issue and the U.S. But I think it's interesting that the arguments on both sides are very much still the same, kind of in both places.
You know, this is, in some respects, a very highly complicated issue. You know, it deals with deeply personal decisions by individuals and by their families. Questions are raised about the age at which these take place, the consequences trans individuals and where and how they can participate in some aspects of life, like sports. Probably unsurprisingly, I support, you know, giving people the freedom to do what they believe they should and they must. But the issue is not just about that. And, you know, a lot of the pushback that you hear on issues like this from the, quote, anti-woke right is trying to force not only a limitation on the rights of people to act on their gender identity. It's trying to force us back to traditional gender roles. And that's not just like, you know, dealing with the trans issues. It's also dealing with the subjugation of women. And so you have the evolution of things like trad wives, you know, traditional wives in the right. You've got some of these people speaking on the right in various countries, not just here, Russia, other places, Hungary, where they're saying, you know, we need to go back to the role of, you know, women, in a subordinate role, and males, playing a traditional role, you know, on top in society. So it's not just about this. This is an issue that they feel gives them some traction to say, no, let's not have progress. Let's not let people exercise autonomy over their own bodies. Let's not let people pursue in a more truthful way, their own identities. This is saying, no, we want to go back to, you know, daddy goes to work, daddy's in charge, mommy stays home, mommy cooks, mommy works for daddy, the kids work for daddy. That's the way the world needs to continue to be. It's pernicious as hell. It's wrong. And, this is an issue that is going to continue to divide societies for quite some time to come, I think, until people adjust to this new, more tolerant reality, which I believe ultimately in the long run they will. In any event, good group of stories, great work early in the morning getting up and getting those stories from Riley and Chris. And we have got a full schedule for you today, including the Mothership, the main Deep State Radio podcast, and another Daily Blast podcast. This one, a conversation with a New Jersey Congresswoman, Mikey Sherrill, definitely worth hearing on a host of issues. She's very smart. And so we hope you'll join us for those. And until then, thank you. Bye-bye.